All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. Here we are again for the big finale in our Articles of Faith series, the big number 4. And once again, we've assembled another fabulous panel. Fabulously to my right is the lovely Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello, John, and everybody else.
Hello, on behalf of everybody else. This is not a usual occurrence tonight. We're sitting here alone in studio, fist in your face, in Studio X.
Well, then we can smooch.
We are, well, I won't say if we're naked or not.
Oh.
But you're not in the hot.
It's arbitrary.
It's ambiguous.
All right. Not in the hot tub.
And from the four corners of the netherworld, we have four other fabulous panelists. First, joining us after it's been a little while. Welcome back, Robin.
Oh, I am so glad to be here. And I think because Zilpha is the lovely Zilpha, perhaps I can be the chaste and benevolent Robin.
Chaste and benevolent. I like that.
Chaste and benevolent.
People say, we've got a lot of comments that you have a sexy voice, Robin.
Well, thank you. I'd like to hope so.
They don't ever say that about me.
Yeah, why do they only say that about the women?
I'll have you point out that I have called both male and female panelists lovely.
Yeah, but
you know
it's probably because
you
just
thing.
Couldn't think of
men can be
word.
Lovely.
Yes.
I know many lovely men.
What about men of good report?
And speaking of lovely, here's Brant. Hey, Brant, welcome back.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Brant is like the light beer of Mike Tannehill's.
I'd agree with that.
Maybe the root beer.
And balancing out Brant is Matthew. Hey, Matthew.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome back.
Good to be here.
And we have one virgin with us tonight, Troy. Hey, Troy.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Do you want to say anything about yourself for our lovely listeners?
Sure. I'm Troy. I am... I'm with Brant and Mike in the believing side. I don't know what beer to compare myself with. And I live on the East Coast. I've been listening to Mormon Expression ever since it came out. And I think I've listened to every episode, maybe skipped a couple, but I think I've heard just about all of them.
Well, welcome.
Thanks.
Since you're on the East Coast, you're probably a liberal, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
In fact, the Occupy DC guys are right across the street from my office, so I get to see them every day in a little tent city that they've constructed there.
My advice to all sort of hippie people out there in the future is if you're going to start a big protest that you want to go on for a long time, don't start it right before the winter. I'm with the mayors that say, I think the first sleet storm is going to break this one up, but we'll see.
Hey, it worked for Brigham Young, right?
Which
just start just before winter.
Yep.
Sending out the hand cards.
Yep.
Well, that was more Franklin D. Richards, but that's a podcast for another time.
Podcast for another day.
Okay. So we have gone to recap for the, should I put you on the spot? Have any of you guys actually, I guess we've only released one at this point. So I won't hold you. I won't even ask you guys if you've listened to it, but,
I have too.
Okay, good. So you got a lot of our introduction, and we have made it all the way through to number 10 of the Big 13. And of course, you know, one of the questions that we have as we go through is how much of a creed is this? So I want to return to that, and then we're going to sort of do the wrap up review at the end. But without further ado, let's jump in at article number 11. Robin, can you read us article number 11?
I sure can. 11. We claim the privilege of worshiping Almighty God according to the dictates of our own conscience and allow all men the same privilege. Let them worship how, where, or what they may.
I like this one.
This is sort of Nauvoo Joseph Smith, definitely. And there are those tensions, especially in early Mormonism, between a sort of a big tent, wide tolerance, and we're the only true church, and we're going to invade Missouri with our troops, sort of thing.
And I'm going to be the king of the world.
Yeah, I'm king of the world, sort of thing. But hey, the committee that elected Joseph Smith king of the world had 3 non-members on it. So there you go.
And I'm sure that they weren't part of the ones who voted.
No, they voted. They apparently voted for him. He had a non-Mormon contingency.
Wow.
I really like this, and I wish this, and this has come up. There's been several periods of liberalization in the church, the late polygamy period, during the 20s when the whole world went that way, and so this sort of bubbles up and then gets suppressed back down, but it's something that I really like.
I think part of the reason why it's in here is because they felt like they were being denied this right, and they wanted to, sometimes when you're sarcastic, you kind of say the opposite of what's actually going on so that people can see the truth. And I think part of the reason why he put it in here is so that people would be like, oh, yeah, well, we're not allowing them that necessarily.
Especially because this one, number 11 and number 12, are both, like John said, out of the Nauvoo period. And it's both Joseph trying to at least show people, look, we're trying to be just like you, and we're trying to do our own thing, and granted, it shifts a little bit during that period, but I think that's what he's trying to say there, is that fact.
Yeah, and I think that's, we've pointed that out in some of the other episodes, that this whole thing written to a non-Mormon audience really goes about trying to show how Christian the Mormon faith is, and this is another one of those.
Well, and just...
Well, I was going to say, I think... sorry,
Robin, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just saying perhaps it showed a little bit of Joseph's revelatory powers. Anyone who frequents any of the boards, Postmo, exmormon.org, this is probably one of the most quoted articles of faith when someone's running into troubles with their families. So truly, I think he was thinking of us and those who may part at some point and throwing us a bone.
Well, I think not only is he, showing faithfulness to, what was said before, but it also appears that there's some faithfulness here to some of the ideals of the American founding. And that's something that is going to be returned to in Article 12 for sure. But this idea that, you can worship as you want, that there shouldn't be any interference with that. And of course, Joseph's claiming that for himself because he wants it to be extended to him, but I think he's also making an argument to a secular audience that's not that far removed from the point in time when the First Amendment was written, and there was this idea that government should not be involved with religion, and so he's saying, hey, we ought to be left alone. Isn't this sort of part of our ideal in this, new experiment of a country that we have?
Mm-hmm.
Was this before? I think this came out before he was running for president.
This did. This is 42. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, but I think that in 11 and 12, some of the ideals he was running on come out here, and I think I know in the first episode, the panel made the point that with these articles that they can be read from the outside one way and from the inside another way, and I think that's true with this one. With, as Zilpha said, from the inside perspective, it's kind of like, hey, you're not, the outside world's not treating us the way that we would like to be treated. We just kind of want to be left alone and worship how, where, what we may. But on the outside, it also sounds good that, hey, these guys don't really want to bother us. In fact, I used to think of this on my mission all the time while I was spending 12 hours a day bothering people and trying to convince them to worship other than how, where, or what they may. Mm-hmm. But that's beside the point.
Well, Troy, that's interesting because you kind of piggybacked a little bit about what Robin was saying, and I know it was in jest, but this whole concept of maybe people on the other side of the Mormon coin that are ex-Mormon or whatever, wanting to worship God how they want, and that kind of leads into the New York Times article that's been passed around about Anne Frank being a Mormon and compelling people to view things from the mainstream active believing Mormon point of view that we feel that we know exactly how God's supposed to be worshipped compared to other people who are worshiping the same Almighty God, but in their own different methods and different ways.
Well, since everybody's having a love fest, I guess I'm the one who has to point out the snark in this one, which is to leave it on the what. You know, if you accuse somebody of worshiping a what, there's sort of a backhanded.
Oh, good point,
like,
John.
Like nobody would claim to worship a thing. So the saying, let all men worship how, where, what they may is
whatever the heck they want.
Is sort of a little snarky, isn't it?
I never thought of it that way. In fact, I remember you mentioned that I'm a liberal. I guess I was back in high school when we had the baccalaureate thing where you had it was supposed to be kind of a pseudo-religious ceremony, and there would be an opening and closing prayer, and I was lobbying that one of the prayers be given by someone who didn't really worship the Christian God. And I was thinking of this article of faith. You know, they could be, you know, worship what they may. You know, it could be a Wiccan. I really was hoping to get a little diversity there, but didn't happen. And I grew up in Utah, by the way, so
I
think we had two Mormon prayers.
I did hear on the news today when I was driving home, there's this Amish cult. Have you guys heard about this that's kind of exploding? This guy, standard cult leader stuff, you know, set up a cult and started taking women away from men and started sleeping with all of his adherents and stuff like that. And anyway, they had it, and they would cut the other men's beards. This is in the news, like now.
It was some kind of thing where they like run up to them, cut their beard or cut the women's hair.
Right, and then run off.
Which is considered like the ultimate insult within that community.
Right, but you know, my point is, be it Jim Jones or God, the reason I bring this up is they had an interview with this guy, and he asserted the right of freedom of religion, and you know, so do the FLDS and all that kind of stuff. 42 was when Joseph Smith was right in the height of polygamy. This sort of might be less about, hey, everybody, let's all be groovy together, and more about, hey, back off.
Leave us the heck alone.
Yeah, we claim the privilege of worshiping God according to dictates of our conscience, which is sort of saying, if we're in the act of worshiping God, we can do whatever we want. So, you know, I still stand by that. I think it's a great passage and one to live by, but, you know, it's oftentimes freedom of religion is used by people who want to abuse it oftentimes.
So you question the true motivation of this one?
I don't necessarily question it, but I know that's feeding into it. You know, and Joseph had been persecuted for his beliefs for a long time. And that was one of his, you know, planks. You know, Troy mentioned the presidency that comes later is, you know, he really wanted to give religion a wide berth. All right. Well, any more thoughts on number 11? Okay, well, let's move to its sister verse, number 12. Zilpha, would you read that one for us?
Let someone else read it, because I'm on all the time.
Oh, I was trying to get the lovely voices. So let's go to our next lovely voice, Matthew.
We believe in being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, and magistrates, in obeying, honoring, and sustaining the law.
Oh, you do you? All right, who wants to go first? Well,
I was using that sort of as the royal we.
This one's kind of – because they had trouble. They were making their own laws that were contradictory to, like, a lot of the like state laws and United States laws that they were supposed to be subject to, but they were making their own laws in Nauvoo.
I have lots of problems with this one, but I want to let other people. There's a long history of lawlessness in the church, and the church would always, in their defense, say, well, we're obeying God's law, and God's law becomes before man's law. I mean, read the first book of Nephi with him cutting off Laban's head to steal a book. You know, so that sort of stuff, that sort of theme comes up all the time.
But I think they were just trying to placate the people who are afraid of them not obeying laws. Like, I think they're just trying to make their neighbors feel better with this one.
Well,
like, because they were accused of doing all kinds of underhanded things and not obeying laws.
Well, in the churches, I think it's more fundamental. In the church's defense, this is an inane statement. No one believes in carte blanche being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, and magistrates, including the church. I mean, that's ridiculousness at a high point.
True.
Because it's saying, whatever the king says, we believe in that. And what sort of integrity is that? Does anybody really believe that?
Well, it doesn't say they believe it, but it just says they'll be subject.
It says we believe.
Well, we believe in being subject to kings.
Nobody believes completely in being subject to any whim that a king.
Maybe Mormons do.
No, they don't.
Did anybody else have a look at DNC 134 as they were looking over this?
That must have been Revelation, Matt, because I was just going to go there.
Yeah, that section has a lot more specific on how this is viewed. And this particular article sets forth the church's view sort of theologically of what government is and how it fits in. And you get a lot more specific statement of it in DNC 134, and I'll paraphrase a little bit, but it begins, "We believe that governments were instituted of God for the benefit of man. So they're not simply man-made creations, but God institutes them." And then, you know, as you go through the verses, it talks about that in order for governments to be successful, they have to secure life, liberty, and property, which, again, is right out of the Enlightenment. It's a natural law argument. It's right there embedded in the Fourth Amendment. It also says that human law should never interfere with religious practice or never control your conscience. But let me read a couple of verses here I think are interesting. "We believe that all men are bound to sustain and uphold the respective governments in which they reside, while protected in their inherent and inalienable rights by the laws of such government, and that sedition and rebellion are unbecoming every citizen thus protected, and should be punished accordingly, and that all governments have the right to enact such laws as in their own judgments are best calculated to secure the public interest, at the same time, however, holding sacred the freedom of conscience. We believe that every man should be honored in his station, rulers and magistrates as such being placed for the protection of the innocent and the punishment of the guilty, and that to the laws all men show respect and deference, as without them peace and harmony would be supplanted by anarchy and terror." So you've got this view here that government is basically good, and it's been put there by God, and it's, you know, for everyone's benefit. Which again harkens back to, you know, to the founding ideas a little bit, that you have all these ideas of the Enlightenment that are stated, but on the other hand, this is a sensibility of, you know, what 1830s, early 1840s America, where they've lived through the Revolution, they've lived through the French Terror, they understand what it means to have the upheaval of a revolution. So, and that's why, you know, I'm not going to read all the verses, but it essentially goes on to say, you have to try to seek redress through your government first. You don't disobey it. You go to the government first, and that's the avenue that you go to. That's the order that God intends.
Well,
I think that's the key. You have to look at it within a vacuum of the 1840s, because honestly, even the church has done things that have gone behind the back of government, where whether it's bribing officials for missionaries' visas or what was going on in East Germany when the wall was up. I mean, the church has done that kind of thing, but it's almost as if, like John said, we use this when it's convenient to us, and then there's other times where we can say, well, it was 1840s America and everything that you had said. So it's an interesting article of faith to look at and say, okay, where do we actually fall on it?
Well, interesting your analysis, Matthew, which I agree with. But you know, in 1942, when this came out, that was sort of the height of the power of the Nauvoo Charter, and you know, Joseph had run afoul of governments over and over again, and they sort of learned their lesson and set up a very powerful government structure in Nauvoo, of which he was at the head, and he also wanted people to back off and sort of let them be. But after this is when they went to, I don't know exactly the date, but when they went to Washington to seek redress for the loss of property in Missouri. And I would add, in my opinion, rightfully so. And they were sort of, you know, nobody listened to them very much. And this is well before the Civil War and settled the states' rights issue. But the government said basically, hey, it's a states' rights issue. But after that, Joseph became very disillusioned with government intervention. But at this time, he was sort of at the height of his optimism. And I think the church, in the next couple years and under Brigham Young, became very dark about the whole thing.
Sure. Well, and he's also defending his own sort of divine right to power. He's, you know, sort of in some ways, in many ways, at the head of the government there. And as you say, with the Nauvoo Charter, and being able to get himself, you know, his own writ of habeas corpus, that was all about the fact that he needed to be able to get himself out of jail when other places incarcerated him. So I agree with that.
Well, I remember being taught as a teenager that people who were in Germany during the time of the Nazis were not to be held responsible for simply going along with what their government was telling them to do.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. This has put the church into some, and continues to put the church into these weird, weird rhetorical positions. Because, you know, famously, the Mormon bishops in Germany in the 30s and 40s who were, you know, Nazis, were excommunicating people for standing up against the Nazi regime. And the church still sort of stands by that, you know, says, oh, you know, everybody's okay in that circumstance.
Because they were obeying the law.
And then even though, you know, the rhetoric was so charged during the 60s, 70s, and 80s from the church authorities against the communists, you know, when the Iron Curtain came down and missionaries went in, it was sort of like, okay, well, I guess we'll baptize communists now. You know, it has the church sort of talking out of both sides of its mouth and really doing the same thing the Catholics have been accused of in World War II, of not standing up against real big evil. Mm-hmm. You know, the church is all over, you know, Playboy, but when it comes to things like, you know, fascism or Nazism, we're neutral on that because Article of Faith 12, which is really a ridiculous position.
You know, one other thought that I had, if I can do a little thought exercise while I was looking at this, is I wonder what would have happened to the church if Joseph had just lived 5 more years to be exposed to sort of the major thread that evolves in American discourse, sort of in opposition to this idea that government is basically good, which is that of civil disobedience. Henry David Thoreau publishes Civil Disobedience only, I think, 4 or 5 years after Joseph was born. Listen to this brief quote that's in it. It's so opposite. He says, "It is not desirable to cultivate a respect for the law so much as for the right. The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time what I think is right. Law never made men a whit more just, and by means of their respect for it, even the well-disposed are daily made agents of injustice. I cannot for an instant recognize as my government that which is the slave's government also." I think if Joseph had lived, he would have loved this. I think he would have glommed right onto it. But you sort of see that thread beginning at that point in history, and then it leads right into the American Civil Rights Movement, which maybe we can talk about in a minute. There's some pretty strong reaction against from the church, which is embedded right in this article of faith.
Yeah, I think Joseph would have liked it. I think he would have got a lot of reading done in prison.
But like I said in the beginning, though, I do think that this was Joseph's attempt to get people to stop accusing the Mormons of being lawless.
Yes, I agree.
Well, and this wasn't originally directed to the church. This is directed to an outside audience. So in a sense, I look at it as him trying to say, look, we're trying to be just like you guys, and we're trying to do the same things that you do, and we're trying to follow the laws. See, here I have. I wrote it down. But when we get into the aftermath, we can talk about the Articles of Faith now. But that was kind of the impression that I got, was as he's writing this trying to tell other people, you've heard a lot of stories about how we're crazy and we're lawless and all this stuff, but we're trying to follow the laws just like you guys are.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And do people, and I don't know if we want to save this for aftermath, but do people feel like that Latter-day Saints today really have much of interest or stomach for civil disobedience, for disobeying the government under any circumstances? I mean, I think that there's a lot of real conservatism in the church that says don't do that. I mean, it's a big flavor in American culture to, you know, all of the protests that are going on right now. I wonder how many Latter-day Saints are doing that.
Yeah, I don't.
I think unless it directly affects them. Like Prop 8 was something that directly affected the church, whereas Occupy Wall Street, for most of the membership who is pretty conservative and pretty Republican, that's going to be something where they're going to say, well, they're just crazy hippie liberals.
But the church has taken this to heart, I think, to that point that, you know, the church operates within the lobby sort of means. I think even for things they believe strongly in, you know, the Mormons, for example, are never to be found protesting outside of abortion clinics. That's just not their style, and it's not that sort of thing is frowned upon. So I think there's a strong element of obeying and the appearance of obeying the law in Mormon culture.
It's this whole idea in the Restoration that there is an order to things. And yes. They, you know, so often lay the choice out as either you're going to follow what's orderly or there's going to be anarchy. Sorry to keep going to quotes, but there's one more real good one from N. Eldon Tanner when he was in the first presidency in 1975. So just in the, you know, recent experience of the civil rights movement, he quotes with approval this in General Conference. He says, "In reality, the man who defies or flouts the law is like the proverbial fool who saws away the plank on which he sits. And a disrespect or disregard for law is always the first sign of a disintegrating society. Respect for law is the most fundamental of all virtues. For the alternative to the rule of law is that of violence and anarchy. There is no reason or justification for men to disregard or break the law or try to take it into their own hands. Christ gave us the great example of a law-abiding citizen when the Pharisees trying to entangle him, as the scriptures say, ask him if it were lawful to give tribute money unto Caesar. After asking whose inscription was on the tribute and their acknowledgement that it was Caesar, he said, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and to God the things which are God's. But the problem is, at some point, Caesar's going to cross the line. Caesar's going to demand something of you that is not right. And that goes back to Thoreau's point, which is, you should be more concerned about what's right than what's lawful.
Yeah, well,
that was an awesome quote.
I think the Mormons have achieved what Joseph Smith was trying to do, which is complete political control. And I think they're a little bit more savvy these days. I'm not trying to push any kind of conspiratorial theory, but the Mormons have a super majority in the House, in the judgeships, in everything in the state of Utah, if you count practicing LDS people. So they have been known, you know, every couple of years to wield power and call people. And it doesn't take much for them to say, hey, you know, the church believes strongly in this point and everybody who hears is going to vote with it. So what I'm saying is I think you get some of that strong belief in the rule of law because in Utah, they control the law and they're disproportionately represented in the National House. And Senate and judgeships and other things like that.
I wonder,
Brant and Troy, what are you? I mean, you guys are still sort of in the thick of it. What's your sense in the congregations that you're in about how people, you know, view the law as opposed to what's right?
Go ahead, Troy.
View the law as opposed to what's right. you know, this one just doesn't come up that much, other than. I think that during the Prop 8 campaign, and I'm 3,000 miles away from that, but to the extent that we talked about it at all, I think the idea was, well, we disagree with the law out there, and so we're going to work through proper channels to try and change it because we believe in being obeying, honoring, and sustaining the law. I think just because the main body of the church is so conservative, it just probably wouldn't enter into that many people's mind to go out and enter into acts of civil disobedience. I could go check across the street tomorrow if there's anyone wearing the authorized pattern over there, but, I'd highly doubt it.
See, I personally think that, and maybe it's because, like Troy, I'm in an area where there's not a lot of Mormons. We are so concerned out here in Detroit just about our image, how we're perceived. We don't want to act like we are in any way affiliated with someone crazy or something that wouldn't be part of your normal mainstream, mainline religion. So if there was anything going on out here that would cause people to step out of line in a civil obedience sort of action, I don't know if you'd ever see that out here because we're so concerned with our view of things. But I'd be intrigued, you know, with the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy DC. I'd also be intrigued to see, I mean, there was civil disobedience happening within wards out in California during Prop 8. So it's on the majority, I think just because the church politically is so conservative that they don't want to do anything that would seem unseemly just for the church's image and for the fact that most of your issues are going to be moral and social issues, not some of the big issues that are happening now, which seem to be more financial in nature.
That, by the way, that was a great loaded question I asked, wasn't it? Take note, John. I'm a student.
Well, one thing that I just realized, which you probably all already realized, was that he said this while he was already practicing polygamy, which was officially against the law, wasn't it?
Yeah, bigamy was against the law.
So, yeah, apparently he doesn't really believe this.
Although at this point, he might have identified it as spiritual wifery. Joseph Smith in his due time has broken many laws.
Yeah. But I wonder if the current attitude of the church has to do with the fact that we finally had to bow down and say, okay, we will not practice polygamy so that we can be a state. And then from that point on, it's like all about we are true Americans, law-abiding citizens. We're, you know, Like we just kind of got broken.
Yeah, I mean,
and then that's how we rebuilt.
There's been many who've made that argument. The post-manifesto, post-polygamy, the church needed a new identity. World War I came along, and they sort of embraced uber-Americanism, you know, and I think there's a good case to be made there. All right, any more thoughts on sustaining the law? I am the law, said Judge Dredd.
Well, one comment I was thinking, although maybe this is aftermath, I don't know, but it just seems like the application it has currently now, or one of them I have heard about, is this being one of the selling points in opening up an area to missionaries, is that it may increase, you know, the populace, they're obeying the laws of the land.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I never thought of this, but if you go through back copies of the church news, you'll see all these pictures of like general authorities with like Chairman Mao and all these people, all these like bad people as they try to kowtow and get into their countries. It's funny you don't see all the in the hall of world leaders in like the Church History Museum or anything like that, you know, of the general authorities of all these bad dudes. But yeah, I think there's a general feeling that they sort of represent themselves as, hey, you know, we teach the people to be good citizens.
That's because they're not worried about building earthly kingdoms. And I mean, I really think that they believe this. Their focus is if we can get the gospel into this place, and I can remember thinking this in my true believing days, that the real salve for what's wrong in the world, what's wrong in a communist country, is spreading the gospel there. We're not going to worry about what this government is doing. If we can get our foot in the door, that's going to be the thing that solved the problem. And that seems to be their approach. It's why they sort of sidle up to some of these folks, I believe.
Yeah,
I think that principle was taught in conference. I can't name the specific general authority that said it, but I mean, your words, Matthew, the salve that's going to heal the countries from their, you know, their problems or their corrupt government or whatever is the gospel. I'm sure I've heard that in conference before, stuff like that.
It sounds a lot like a general authority. You might be mistaken.
That's right.
You need to throw more evens into your clauses.
Well, okay, I know we're gonna move on, but let me just address what Matt said, especially because you did tell me to bring my A game. So you're telling me that while the church is trying to get the church into different countries, maybe even a place like China, which does have a really bad track record of human rights abuses, that we should have nothing to do with these leaders at all. Aside from the fact that we're not getting in there to convert the leaders. We're getting in there to convert the people. And the people sometimes don't have any say in what the leaders are doing, especially in places like Russia was and like China is.
No, I'm not saying that at all. And in fact, I think that they're very sincere. I mean, in other words, what is their alternative to stand on principle and say, well, we're not going to go into China until human rights improve. I think that they sincerely believe that the way they improve human rights and the way that they make a better government there is by bringing the gospel to those people. I don't intend that as a criticism.
I want to use their own words against them, because people like Ezra Benson and David O. McKay and N. Eldon Tanner and those guys were calling these countries, you know, the tools of Satan. And the, you know, the grand conspiracy, the rhetoric are coming from not just these guys, but general authorities all across the board in the late 50s and 60s was just over the top. I don't think people realize how bombastic conference was during that period. And then during the lifetime of these guys, to then turn around and, putting tongues where they shouldn't ought to be, they were just ready to just kowtow right up to them. And so I would say the only standard with which the church should be judged on this front is the standard the church set for itself. And no one has ever gotten up in Congress and repudiated one word from those bastards. It all sits there in the record.
In Congress?
No, in conference. What do you?
You said Congress.
Oh, conference, yeah. Yeah, no one has ever said anything. You know, we have the civil rights is a communist plot and a tool of the devil. Talks in conference. No one's ever contradicted that at all. The doctrine stands.
Well, so what should they do? Should they get up and say, well, we shouldn't have said this?
Absolutely. They should say we were wrong.
But the problem with doing that, look, from an organizational standpoint, the problem with doing that is you're calling more attention to what's going on.
I think the studies have shown over and over again, at least from a business side, because that's where my expertise is, companies that get up and claim responsibility and fix what they do wrong do much better. You know, if they
but
say
they're not doing that anymore, though.
Who's not?
It's
doing
a different
that?
Story. It's a different story. If at this last conference they were getting up and saying some of those bombastic things, but they're not doing that anymore. As a matter of fact,
Brent, you're not going to be able to play the card on me that everything that the Mormon authorities say has an expiration date.
Oh,
it stands until it's repudiated, and you can't just say they're not saying it anymore.
No, the card that I'm trying to play is the card of a developing and maturing religion, because they did the same thing to the Catholic Church around the 1950s and 60s, especially when Mormon doctrine came out. They were so bombastic. Even the temple ceremony had different religions in there, and they've gotten away from that, frankly, because they realized that's just inappropriate to do.
But if you say the Mormon Church is a developing religion, you've kicked out the foundation of the whole thing, because it is about restoration. It is about everybody else had this wrong, but now we have a direct voice to God. And if you say, no, we were just learning bit by bit and we didn't know what we were doing, then you just as well be a Methodist.
No, what I'm trying to say is the church is built on continuing revelation, because what you're doing is you're kicking the other half of the church out by saying, nope, the way it was in Joseph Smith's time is the only way it can be. There can be no change and no learning at all.
Well, I would say that the principle of continuing revelation demands that – like when you go through college, when you go to the first year of mathematics, you don't get into the third year and then say, all that stuff we taught you was just the milk. Now we're going to teach you the meat, and it all contradicts the first year stuff. No, they build upon it. If there's continuing revelation that builds upon, I can buy that. But this constant flip-floppy stuff doesn't sell it to me.
Well, and just changing. How about a plain, very simple kindergarten approach? How about saying, I'm sorry, because these things do affect people. And even if it was done with the best intentions, when it doesn't have the best outcome, just say you're sorry.
I mean, I'll use an example to build on what Robin's saying of what Bruce Armakonkie said after they restored gave the priesthood to the blacks. It wasn't a full-on apology, but part of it was good, which was saying we were wrong. We were speaking with, we didn't have the full light. And it's time for the church to repudiate all that communist stuff, but they just want it to go away. They don't want to acknowledge that they ever said that baloney.
Yeah, isn't it? I wonder if it's just so long ago that happened that it would be kind of weird if they got up and repudiated the stuff that was said about the anti-communist stuff that President Benson used to say. I mean, President Benson died.
I agree.
25
Troy.
Years ago,
that would be, it would be weird.
I would agree, Troy. But I live in Utah County, and they're still they are still saying this stuff from the pulpit down here.
Say no more.
And maybe
John, John, do you know any Birchers down there?
I know plenty of Birchers, yeah.
It's around.
It's still around.
I've forgotten about the living in Utah or Utah County. Davis County's not much better where I grew up. So,
look, John, the solution
to this. What about Glenn Beck?
Yeah, Glenn Beck.
The solution to this is very simple. Zion is east of the Mississippi. Three of us are east of the Mississippi. You just need come back to Zion, John. That's what we need.
But, yeah, okay.
That would solve it all.
All right. Let's move on to number 13.
Which is everybody's favorite, right?
Unless you're a primary kid and they make you say that one in front of the congregation.
No, I loved that.
For your memorization pass off.
That's true.
Because this one was fun to memorize.
Okay, I'll read this one. We believe in being
overachiever.
We believe in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous, and in doing good to all men. Indeed, we may say that we follow the admonition of Paul. We believe all things. We hope all things. We have endured many things and hope to be able to endure all things. If there's anything virtuous, lovely, or good report, or praiseworthy, we seek after these things.
Unless it's rated R.
No, I do believe that this is a reflection of part of Joseph Smith's character. I do believe he really believed this, and it was reflected in the way he lived his life.
I think he should have stopped after the first sentence, though, because the rest of it's kind of wishy-washy weirdo stuff.
It has sort of the Joseph Smith wishy-washy weirdo flowery prose to it.
But I mean, being honest, true, chaste, well, I don't know about the chaste part, benevolent, virtuous, and in doing good to all men, I can't argue with that stuff.
Except
I mean, it's pretty universal, but it is different than all of the other articles of faith in that it starts out, we believe in being. So whereas all the others are statements of, you know, what Mormons believe, this is the statement where he's saying, and in addition to believing differently, we want to stand out in terms of our conduct, and we have a very high and lofty goal for what that ought to be.
But who doesn't believe in being honest, true, benevolent, virtuous, and doing good to people?
Well, your husband, I mean.
What? What part of John is not benevolent?
I believe in everybody should get what they deserve. That's what, I'm with you.
You know, that's a great comment, Zilpha, because that's one thing I was thinking about is, you know, very often, I mean, I couldn't come up with an exact example when I was trying to think of it, but where you talk about someone, wow, they did a great job. They were so honest and forthright, did this and that. And then someone turns around and says, well, that's what they're supposed to do. That's the job description. That's, you know, so really, that's the job description of being a human being. Why is that so special?
Right, I agree.
My only issue is the third clause needs to go. It doesn't follow. It's a non sequitur. The we endure many things and hope we'll endure all things. The editor should have penciled that one out.
Well, and you know, we believe all things. Nobody believes all things. That's ridiculous.
But Joseph kind of did, didn't he? I mean, isn't this sort of a great statement of Joseph Smith's universalism? I mean, I think this is Joseph speaking right from the heart. He pulled from – I mean, of course, if you have a cynical view like I do, he pulled it from everywhere to create his movement. He pulled from all kinds of different places, you know, to write the scriptures he did. I think that he really deep down believed this. You know, if this piece of truth comes from here, great. If this piece of truth – comes from another location. It doesn't matter where it came from.
Well,
we're going to look at it. We're going to examine it, and if it fits, if it works, we're going to take it. We're going to bring it in.
I agree that's how he did it. But why didn't he add in "we believe all true things"?
Well, I agree. I think for Joseph, is somebody eating a piece of candy or something?
Sorry, I'm flipping through my scriptures here just to find the cross reference to Paul.
No, I think Joseph would follow that. We believe all things. That is a Joseph Smith thing. And we forget now in this highly correlated church how much at the time, and even into Brigham Young's time, the church would bring in secular stuff and poetry and plays and whatever. I mean, I've got old church manuals from like some from the 60s where they're all just full of secular prose.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's what they taught in church.
And that's what they taught in church.
School.
There's that old great We Sing book that's full of all old Negro spiritual or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, people ask why they sing Give Said the Little String and stuff because they used to do tons of that stuff. It didn't all have to be religion. And I think this speaks to that foundation of how broad Mormonism was.
Well, and correlation sort of killed all of that, didn't it? I mean, even to the point with, you know, in the last few years, I can't remember if it was a talk or a memo that was discouraging people from bringing in outside sources to their lessons. So, you know, the only things that you really hear anymore is a, you know, a good C.S. Lewis quote that fits in or Nietzsche. Anybody else heard Nietzsche said across the pulpit? All the time I would hear, whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger. I thought that was great in sacrament meeting coming from the guy that said, God is dead and we have killed him.
Yeah. Hey, will to power.
Awesome.
Exactly. Oh, okay.
Just a quick thing at the end here, John. Just okay. Going off of what Troy originally said at first, you know, the last line about it, if there's anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. And he said, unless it's rated R. You know, let me tell you this. One of the proudest moments was when I was able to convince a couple members of my ward to watch the King's speech. And they came back to me and they said, thank you so much. I was so worried because it was an R rating, but thank you so much for recommending that because that was a wonderful movie. And the sad thing about that mentality is the fact that there are many things out there that really are virtuous, lovely, things like that. I know I've said it before that my wife had a spiritual experience reading Shakespeare, and actually she was reading Macbeth. And if you think about Macbeth, that's a horrible, horrible story, but she actually had a great experience with that. But how many times do we, kind of like you talked about with the Elder Ballard memo that was sent out saying only use what's in the correlated manuals, how many times do we forget to take a look outside of what we have within Mormonism and find those virtuous and lovely things out there?
Yeah, and I think to be fair that a lot of people are doing that. I mean, anecdotally, the Mormons I know and the ones that I know online and, you know, particularly in the internet age, they're looking to all kinds of sources and finding all kinds of things, whether it's, you know, Eastern religion or, you know, Islam or, you know, what have you. And they don't seem to be afraid to incorporate those things into their worldview as long as they can, you know, sort of make it line up. I think people are increasingly willing to do that. It's almost sort of a restoration, if you will, of, the view that Joseph seemed to have here.
Yeah, I mean, I think according to Google Analytics, Mormons like all types of porn.
Gosh.
No, I...
Oh, boy.
I like how Joseph... Are we done with 13 or are we going to...
Do you have a thought on 13?
No, well, it comes right after 13. It's the end to the letter. It says, respectfully, etc.
Yeah.
Joseph Smith.
Okay. Yeah, that's the end of the letter.
Well, I don't know. I guess he liked etc.
I think it was more common in the writing of the time.
Maybe.
Yeah, so let us do get into the aftermath a little bit. Once again, the question I brought up at the top of the hour and in previous ones is this a creed? And I want to point out many of the things that aren't in the 13 Articles of Faith. There's no mention of families. There's no mention of the temple. There's no mention of eternal marriage. There's no mention of the priesthood. Those are just some of the things off the top of my head. The things that define Mormonism more than anything else today, if you said what makes Mormonism, none of them are in the Articles of Faith.
It doesn't even say follow the prophet.
Yeah, it doesn't. It stresses obedience. It has obedience in number 3.
It has the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, but the Book of Mormon, you can't derive Mormonism from the Book of Mormon.
And it doesn't say to read the Book of Mormon, and it's missing the Pearl of Great Price and the Doctrine and Covenants.
But what I think is amazing about that, I'll let you guys comment, but what I think is amazing about that is that Mormons, especially those in my generation, people younger than... or people older than about 35, we all had to memorize this, and they can't tell that they don't realize that Mormonism is not contained in the Articles of Faith. How is it that that's the case, that people don't say, wait a minute, why do we say these are the most important things when the most important doctrines aren't even in here?
Atonement's in there.
Yeah, some of the important doctrines are, but...
Well, this is the least kooky stuff.
Obey the word of wisdom isn't. Don't have any sexual experiences outside of a marriage relationship isn't.
Oh, chaste.
Well, chaste.
Yeah, but that can mean different things. I mean, look at what Joseph was doing.
Hey, I just read a book 2 days ago by Marky Peterson that was talking about preserving chastity in the marriage, in the marital bed.
Within,
so, yeah, so they define chaste.
Is that a how-to?
Yeah, it's don't do anything, but you know what.
Zilpha, what are you aware of?
What?
Let John talk. This is getting interesting.
I'm sorry. I'll shut up.
No, no. Go ahead.
Oh, no.
They don't mention tithing.
Right. I mean, that's my point. Like, say, what do Mormons do? What do they talk about? Sure.
Family home evening.
But couldn't you say this is a broad overview of Mormonism?
No. I would say the fundamentals of Mormonism today are, if you go to like Mormon.org or anything, it is all about the eternal family. It is all about eternal marriage. Like, if you read the 13 Articles of Faith, you would not say this church has anything wrong, any problem with gay marriage. Right? But I think most Mormons would say, no, that is fundamentally diametric to Mormonism, but not according to the 13 Articles of Faith. So this does not define creedally. Is creediliciously what Mormons believe.
Well, and I know this is blatantly setting myself up, but I'll go down this road anyways. If you think about it, though, what missionaries teach potential investigators and potential converts to the church, the broad overview of Mormonism, all those things you can find within the Articles of Faith. Because if you start going down the road of gay marriage, that is a very specialized area that people think about in the church, and the only reason they're thinking about it a lot right now is because it's in the news so much.
Brent, some of the things that the missionaries are teaching prospective converts are in the Articles of Faith, but not very many of them.
If you stopped an average schmo on the street and said, "What do Mormons believe?" they'd say, "Well, no sex before marriage. They can't drink coffee. They can't drink beer. They wear white shirts." Just none of what defines people as Mormons is here.
But if you also, every time you look at and look, that's a person on the street, okay? So every time you look at a press release or a press release from a big national newspaper or something on TV that's describing the Mormon faith, a lot of those things you can find within the Articles of Faith. Jesus Christ, our belief in God, our belief in three separate beings, our belief in Joseph Smith. Well, that was...
It doesn't...
Ooh, ouch.
that didn't mean to come out there. Our belief in Joseph Smith as a prophet. That's what I meant to say.
It doesn't talk about the great apostasy.
Well, I'm not trying to say that there's nothing of Mormonism in here. We've said over and over again, this is really sort of an appeal to a Christian nation to say, see, we are the same as you guys, a message which clearly has still not taken root. But this was 1842. There was tons of doctrinal innovation that came after this. That's why the temple's not here.
It has speaking in tongues, but it doesn't mention temples.
And it doesn't mention the Melchizedek priesthood. I mean, what does the brethren lord over everybody every 6 months, priesthood. And it's only sort of vaguely even referenced here.
Ooh, did you all talk about the gift of tongues and interpretation of tongues in the other episode?
Oh, yes.
Great.
Okay, well, I won't say more about it then.
We even practiced it.
Awesome.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
And the sacrament, isn't
and you didn't
the sacrament?
Invite me.
Or is the sacrament considered an ordinance? I don't know.
It's considered an ordinance.
I mean, that's pretty important.
It's not. I don't think it really is a creed. I mean, maybe it's partly a creed. It's a snapshot of what was important at the time. And that, John, as you say, so much happened after this. It didn't evolve all at once.
I think it's a very interesting document, but I also believe if Joseph Smith would have written it 10 days later, it would have looked differently.
I agree.
I will put my active believing Mormon card on the line, and okay. I will say, yes, this is a creed. But the problem is, we don't want to define it as a creed because that means that kind of like we talked about, everything that Mormons believe is in here, and the fact that Mormons view the word creed as a dirty word because of things like the Nicene Creed and some of these other creeds where we say, well, no, that's not it. I'm looking at a synonym right now for creed, and the first synonym that comes up is Articles of Faith. It's a statement of your beliefs, isn't it?
But
yeah, but calling it that doesn't make it that.
And in my defense, this was not – that was a post hoc label. When Joseph Smith wrote that, he never said, these are our Articles of Faith. Now, it said it in Times and Seasons when it was published, but,
You know what I didn't do but should have done? We did the Temple Recommend podcast together. It'd be interesting to match this up to that.
They don't match up very well.
That's the other creed.
Yeah, that's more creedy to me than this is. Because I mean, there's a lot of things in here that really aren't creeds at all. Like number 11, we claim the privilege of worshiping Almighty God according to the dictates of our conscience. That's not a statement of belief at all. Other than the word Almighty, that's the only thing in there that tips the hat of what they believe. You know, and even 13, you know, these are terms that are not defined in Mormonism. Mormonism has no, like, catechism on what benevolency is.
That's true. And I've heard that a lot of kids think it says chased by an elephant instead of chased in benevolent, because they have no idea what that means.
What does it mean to be true?
Not so cute.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Loyal.
So let's talk a little bit. Any more thoughts on my dead horse named Creed?
That's more enjoyable to listen to than the band Creed.
I was thinking the same
thing.
Thank
you.
Well, Mormon doctrine, which of course we've gone away from McConkie's Mormon doctrine, but when I was looking it up, his headings all said Creed, Creed, Creed. but of course, you know, we don't pay attention to him anymore.
Right.
Wow.
So this document the Articles of Faith was canonized and has been toting around since 51, 1851, that is. And, of course, Talmage wrote his book, Articles of Faith, which became a great exegesis of the faith. It's probably one of the best early documents. It was published in 1913. That gave a good overview of what Mormonism is. But, you know, like I pointed out in previous episodes, the book seems to use the 13 Articles of Faith as a jumping point for going into things. And, you know, there's some things that aren't really, I don't think are justified by the document. So I think because of all that writing that's been done using the Articles of Faith as its groundwork, I think Mormons tend to think there's more in there than there is.
The missionaries still hand out our Articles of Faith cards.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I believe.
And it's on the website. I went to look, what do Mormons believe? And it is, you know, you can click on it, Articles of Faith. But then there were like 8 other things you could click on that weren't Articles of Faith.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are all kinds of things in here that have been hugely influential since they were written, and who knows whether, you know, Joseph intended them that way. I mean, for example, does anybody know if there's a statement anywhere else about that we believe that the, you know, Bible is the Word of God as far as it's translated correctly? I mean, that's still the stock answer, apologetic answer to almost anything that's wrong with the Bible. But for this, would there be an answer within Mormonism for that? I genuinely don't know.
Yeah,
because he was already working on the translation.
I would agree. That's probably the most important passage from this document, as far as Mormons go. You know, because a lot of it, like we pointed out in the last few hours, has been abandoned, you know, like the gifts of tongues.
Or it's more universal.
Or the ordinances, like in number 4, we've moved way beyond that in terms of what we believe the ordinances of the gospel are. Or like we pointed out just a minute ago, all the things we've added to Mormonism since this was written. That's what's really fascinating about the document is, and I made this point before also, that Mormonism has a clear historical development. And if you don't look at the redacted and rewritten documents, which of course this is one of them, and you look at Mormonism in its development, like if there were a regular historical dealing with Mormonism where they laid out a book on the development of Mormon doctrine, then everybody would see it. But the church has a strong interest, for whatever reason, in trying to prove to everybody that all the doctrines have been there since 1830. And it's just simply not the case. And if you look at this as a slice in time in 1842, it makes perfect sense. But if you try to keep pushing it like it's has as much appeal now as it did then, it gets a little strange.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, a strangeness that's oddly not picked up by most of the members.
Well, it's ours. You know, you love your strange children.
Well, it's just that, and I was there too. I'm not trying to make fun of other people. Just that we each have a blind spot to our own belief systems, where no one comes in here and says, "Wait a minute, where's the temple? Where's marriage?
Where's baptisms for the dead and such?"
Yeah.
Family
maybe
history.
That stuff's more along the line of sacred.
The secret.
Well, I think given the time when these were published, if Joseph Smith would have started talking about marriage, that could have been a little problematic, especially in light of what he was trying to do with these.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and
That seems to be the only – I mean, were there any other important things that had been, you know, revealed at this point that don't appear in here?
Tithing?
Other than eternal marriage?
I would say
word of wisdom?
I'm thinking of the pref – sorry, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, we were just naming things off. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm thinking of the preface or the preamble to section 132. Isn't there something in there to the effect of, you know, we believe this must have been revealed, you know, by 1831 or whatever. So there's the doctrine that attains you the highest level of the celestial kingdom, sort of the crowning, you know, ordinance in you know, the theology. And of course, it's not here.
Right.
That's maybe the only one that really surprises me, because a lot of that other stuff it came later. I mean,
I mean, you got to put it in context. It's 1842. Joseph's insisting everybody calls him General Smith. He's parading around in a big, like, Napoleonic hat.
Hey, he looks hot in that hat.
He carries a sword around with him all the time. He's got 18 secret wives, and then he's saying we believe in sustaining the law and being honest. You know. Joseph
and
was
chased.
And chased, yeah. He was being chased by Emma is what he was being.
Had it been revealed that Cain was Bigfoot by this time, I'd like to add 14. See if we can get that canonized.
It was David Patton, and David Patton is dead by now, who actually ran into Bigfoot back in.
That's right, on his horse.
On his horse, yeah. Yeah, poor David got shot in the belly in the Mormon War in 38.
Ouch.
It's also interesting, moving on from Cain and Bigfoot, it's also interesting that back in 1907, the church actually tried to push out some new articles of faith, and they were spoken by James R. Clark in it's in Messages of the First Presidency, but it does say things like, we believe in the Godhead comprising the three individual persons, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Another one, we affirm that to administer in the ordinance of the gospel, authority must be given to God, and this authority is the power of the holy priesthood.
Clarification.
So there's different ones in there, and from what I saw, it looked like it was affirmed, but nothing happened out of it.
Grant, where did you find that? That's interesting.
That was Improvement Era 10, 481 through 495. Improvement Era, May 1907. That's where it's at.
I think I might have that.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, John's looking for his copy of that.
Brand, do you remember if it said that these were going to be published or replace the articles that we know? I mean, because that would have been right after the Smoot hearings, I think. And it would have made sense if they were trying to put out something similar to the original Articles of Faith to kind of I don't know if save face is the right word, but to reassure the nation that we were law-abiding citizens and you know, for the most part, normal, other than the whole polygamy thing.
Well, that's what it seems like. It seems like they were trying to push this out as a redoubling of the theology of the Mormons, but who knows?
It's almost like pseudepigrapha, right? It's like we're going to take on the style and the voice of Joseph, and then we're going to reiterate or add something new.
You wouldn't even have to pretend that Joseph originally wrote it that way, but you could say, hey, you know, we've updated them. They're more accurate. Right. They're more thorough.
I think that probably roundabout speaks to its longevity. There's nothing real weird in here, you know, and a lot of the stuff that came out in this period, the church has buried or abandoned or changed or rewritten. But this is one they can stick by.
Yeah, the only kind of weird one is the Zion built on the American continent part.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, the rest of it's not that strange.
Wagons East.
Yeah, and maybe that's why it's been so durable, is that it's not. It's something that's easily shared, and hey, look how, you know, look how mainstream we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe we because it's ours, think it's more normal than it actually sounds to an outsider. I don't know, because I've only heard it, you know. I've heard it since I was a little kid.
I mean, have you read the creeds of any of the other churches, though? They're full of weird stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they get really pedantic and clarify positions that nobody cares about anymore. Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I know for me personally, especially when I was in high school, if someone asked about Mormonism on a certain subject that fell in line with the Articles of Faith, it was really easy for me just to say an Article of Faith, and they kind of had a look on their face like, oh, okay, I guess that's what you guys believe.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, any last words on the Articles of Faith? You guys get the final say.
Well, does anyone care if I end on a humorous note and bring in the 14th Article of Faith, which seems to best describe the modern church?
Oh, this is the one that gets passed around. Go ahead.
Of course. I know it's silly, but it's still my favorite. 14th Article of Faith. We believe in meetings, all that have been scheduled, all that are now scheduled, and we believe that there will yet be many great and important meetings scheduled. We have endured many meetings and hope to be able to endure all meetings. Indeed, we may say that if there is a meeting or anything that resembles a meeting or anything that we may possibly turn into a meeting, we seek after these things.
And my believing family actually appreciate that one. So
yeah. I appreciate it.
Oh, I do too. That's
although I think the church is distancing itself since they're starting to say don't plan quite as many meetings. So maybe they took it to heart that this was starting to stick.
They get up and say that. You know, Hinckley one time about, I don't know, 8 years ago gave a big, long discourse about that. He talked about how they'd gone through and they'd evaluated all the meetings. They were looking for reduction. And then he ended the talk. And then 6 months later, they introduced another meeting. So,
yeah, they've been giving lip service to reduction of meetings for years, but I've yet to see the fruits of that.
But, yeah, they're the ones who have to do it, you know. They can't blame this one on the membership.
It'd be nice if they'd start with the 3-hour block and turn it into at least, you know, reduce it by an hour or something.
Well, they're never going to get rid of priesthood or relief society, so they just need to ditch Sunday school.
Or cut the meeting times in half something.
The Asian branches in San Diego, we met for 2 hours. Sacrament meeting was 50 minutes. Perfect. Because you basically had one speaker. You know, for 25 minutes after you get done with announcing everything twice and doing the sacrament. And then we had a 10-minute break and then had a 25-minute Sunday school and a 25-minute priesthood and relief society.
Sounds pretty good. I used to fantasize about how you would shorten that schedule all the time. I always thought you'd just get rid of sacrament meeting, have it be the sacrament only.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh,
I agree with you. That's a great idea.
Hey, Troy's an old guy with me. You remember when they used to do the sacrament in Sunday school, right?
Yep.
There's a reason the old churches have sacrament tables in the primary rooms.
I remember that, too.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, there's precedence.
I mean, you keep fast and testimony meeting because that's the most entertaining thing that happens in church all month, right?
Oh, man.
I mean, that's when people truly get to go off script.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, I'm just hoping that if they decide to cut it down to 2 hours, that they do it hopefully within the next couple of months because we're on the afternoon schedule right now, and I get home from church and the football games are over.
Hmm.
Oh. You mean you watch football on Sunday?
I mean,
I thought
Tabernacle Choir is over.
Keeping the Sabbath day holy is not in the Articles of Faith, so don't worry about it.
Oh, okay.
I thought God.
Of course, just kidding.
Haven't you ever heard the faith promoting talk about how God invented jet airplanes so general authorities could get around to the world? Same thing goes with TiVo, brother.
I actually have heard that TiVo was invented to help us keep the Sabbath day holy.
Well, Thanks, everybody. As always, the discussion continues on this and all the wonderful parts in this series on our website at MormonExpression.com. Make sure to come to the live show November 18th.
Mormon Fight Songs for Dummies.
And sing along. And, of course, the cruise. We've had a few more people sign up in the last couple of days. It should be a lot of fun. January 27th.
Yep, there's a link on there's a link on the website for that too.
And if you the Utah contingency is spending a night in Las Vegas the time before, and we know what that means.
The love
what happens in Vegas.
All right. Well, thanks everybody.
All eyes are on us now. All eyes are on us.